Hello, colleagues, members of the audience. I'm going to call to order this March 2nd, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. We have a number of public hearings. We also have a work session, but those of you who are here for the work session, we don't have the paperwork for it, the fiscal analysis, so we will be carrying that forward to Wednesday. So I'm going to open up with a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 10. Matt, could you tell us what that's about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Concurrent Resolution 10 is an in memoriam for Joanne Austin.
Senator Thatcher, you've moved.
Well, yeah, just kind of the normal flow of things. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
I am, not representative any longer, but now Senator Thatcher from District 13. So, Mr. Chair and dedicated other member of the committee, I'm here today to request your support for SCR 10, which memorializes the late Joanne Austin. Joanne was a true cornerstone of our community, and she... The more I learn about her, the more I think, wow, maybe we should have honored her while she was alive. However, her tireless work in business and philanthropy have benefited thousands of Oregonians, and I believe her work will continue to bless and benefit the lives of thousands of Oregonians and future generations. She is well known for her skill in business, and it is rooted in 1964 when she and her husband founded ADEC Incorporated, and it's a company that is the largest private dental equipment manufacturer in the United States. They're based in Newburgh, and the company is responsible for many important dental innovations, and its equipment is marketed in 100 countries worldwide. And in addition to starting this business with her husband, Joanne was heavily involved in supporting Oregon's small business community, and she was the first woman chair of the board of directors of Associated Oregon Industries, and she also helped build a new school of business at Oregon State University. She was known for her commitment to charity and improving the lives of all Oregonians. She supported programs offering free dental care to low-income children. She was a contributor to drug and alcohol abuse treatment programs. They've given land for many educational, the list goes on and on and on. Education was extremely important to Joanne, and she supported education for Oregonians of all ages. And I could keep going, but for now, I just request that you support the passage of SCR 10.
Thank you, Senator Thatcher. This sounds like a very worthy resolution for this committee. Senator Knope, you have any comments about it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. The Austins have been an incredible giving family to Oregon, and specifically in Newburgh and surrounding areas. And I think it is a very worthy honoring that we would do for her. And I agree with Senator Thatcher that it's too bad that we didn't do more while she was still living, because she certainly deserved the accolades for all that she's done, because it totals in the millions and millions of dollars.
Yes.
Of donations that they've made over time to Oregon institutions and helping any number of different charitable activities.
Great. Well, I agree with Senator Knope. So unless you disagree, Senator Thatcher, I think we have a majority support.
Yes, we do.
So we'll schedule a work session very, very soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for bringing this forward. Okay, with that, I'm going to close this public hearing on SCR 10. And I am going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 686. Matt, can you tell us what this one is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 686 considers an individual enrolled in an alternative education program to be out-of-school youth for the purposes of the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act.
Okay. Karen, can you come forward? Colleagues, I spoke briefly about this when we introduced it as a committee bill. This responds to a new emphasis in the new federal workforce Opportunity and Innovation Act, which is really focusing on out-of-school youth, out-of-work youth. The rules are still being written. The final rules are still being written for that. But they're, I think it is, my understanding is that it's going to be left up to the states to define what we mean by out of school. Karen from CCWD can help us understand that.
Sure.
So, Karen?
Thank you, Chair Dambrow, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Hummelbaugh. I am the Workforce Division Director at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Thank you for having me here today. I was going to, you did a great job of kind of giving the overview. I was going to do a little bit of an overview just to remind you what the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act was and who it serves. That act was passed and will be fully in place by the spring of 2016. It's how we get our federal funding for our youth investment dollars. And while we're waiting for the all of the regulations to come down from the feds, which we don't expect to happen until probably, they say spring, so we're thinking that might even be June, we are moving ahead with all of our planning because we will begin to serve youth with these dollars starting this summer. It used to be under the old federal legislation that we were supposed to serve primarily out of school youth with the in-school youth with the funds, and now we are supposed to spend a majority of the funds on out-of-school youth. We want to make sure that the students who are in programs such as the ones we talked to you and showed you in last week on last Monday, when all of those 100 students were here before this committee, they are folks who are being funded through these programs, through their participation in alternative programs or alternative schools. We want to continue that good work in allowing those students to do their high school completion through those routes. And in this state, we're working closely with the Workforce Investment Board at the state level, the local Workforce Investment Boards, the Youth Development Council, and the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps in order to sort of align the ages in which we serve people and the in and out of school youth. In light of that, we want to make sure that we are defining out-of-school youth as a place where we can say that these folks are being able to be served if they're in an alternative school as being outside of the traditional K-12 system so that we can use these funds. And as we read this, we would like you to consider an amendment to allow for maximum flexibility to serve the students, whether they are in or out-of-school youth, whichever is most flexible for them. I think that's probably it for questions then.
Okay. Colleagues, any questions for Karen? Okay. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
We will look into making those amendments.
Thank you.
Seems like a good, simple bill that will do some good. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 686. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 584. Matt, can you tell us what this bill is about?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, Senate Bill 584 requires the Oregon Business Development Department to suspend public contracting certifications of disadvantaged minority women or emerging small business enterprises that fail to perform a commercially useful function. Becomes operative January 1st, 2016, and declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Okay, thank you. This is an issue for which I thought it would be good if we could start off with some background on just what MWESBs are. So I'm gonna ask Kerry Hulse from Business Oregon to come up and tell us what's meant by that, a little bit of an overview of the history of MWESBs in this state. So welcome, Kerry. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kerry Hulse. I'm the program manager for the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business. Oregon is the sole certification agency for the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise, Minority Business Enterprise, Women Business Enterprise, and Emerging Small Business Enterprise programs. The first three programs, the DBE, M, and W programs, are certifications based on the individual. They are firms owned by minority and women business owners. The Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program is the federal program, and it's related primarily to federal dollars received from FHWA, FAA, and FTA, the transportation monies, primarily directed towards ODOT for transportation-funded projects. This certification, in order to receive the federal funding, they are required, Department of Transportation is required to use a certain number of minority or women-owned firms to meet goals. I think it's important to note that if those goals are not met, they do face consequences of losing federal funding. The Minority and Women Business Enterprise programs mirror the DBE program, but those are state, county, and city and special jurisdiction funded programs, and they cover all state agencies, city, county. Their goals are aspirational targets. They are set by the contracting agency, monitored by the contracting agency. They aren't monitored by anybody else throughout the state, although there is a, I believe it's now a quarterly reporting that's required to the governor's office. The Emerging Small Business Program is based on the business itself, not the individual, and that's based on the size of the business. It is a race and gender neutral program. Benefits of certification for the firms are certainly that there are portions of projects that are available for them to bid on that are set just for them. I believe that the federal DBE program right now, their goals are typically around 10% for each project, and then the state and other agencies, local government agencies, set their own goals, and they can range anywhere from just a few percent to 30%, I believe, is the highest I've heard. Also, networking opportunities, educational opportunities, mentorship programs, that sort of thing. For the first three programs, the requirements are that the firm be owned, controlled by a minority or woman or combination thereof. At least 51% owned by those individuals. They must be a for-profit company, and it must be they must be U.S. citizens, and they must also have all of the professional licensing required. So, for example, if it's an engineering firm, the owner of the firm and applicant must hold that engineering license. There is also a gross annual average receipts over a three-year period of $23.98 million. The company cannot exceed that. Once the firm graduates from that, they cannot come back into the programs. The DBE can be, you can be certified in multiple states, but you're required to be certified in your home state first, and it also has a personal net worth limitation of $1.32 million, not including the equity in your home or the equity in your business. As I said, the ESB certification is race and gender neutral. It is a certification only for Oregon. A firm must be in Oregon based on their federal tax filings. They must hold the licenses, and they must be registered with the Secretary of State. And it cannot be a joint venture. So, for example, two large companies cannot create a little one to take advantage of the program. It is a two-tier program. Each tier is 6 years. And it's the only program that you that expires after 12 years, our hope being that the companies then can stand on their own. And a firm can be certified in multiple programs. Doesn't just have to be one, so we have several that are certified in all four. I also included in the handout the monetary limitations and employee size limitations for the ESB program. Those are set on a yearly basis according to the Consumer Price Index. And then on the last page, I have current statistics. Currently now, we have 3,287 certified firms. Primarily, those are ESB firms. It's the easiest certification to get since it's based on your business. So that's a very high overview. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. And what exactly is your office's role in these programs, Carrie?
And
why is it housed in Business Oregon? What, do you know what the history is there?
I know that the agency has been moved around quite a bit. Originally, it was in the Secretary of State's office. It was in the governor's office at one point. And before OBDD, it was with DCBS. Right now, I believe the reason why we're in OBDD is because it's tied to assisting businesses to grow. We handle the certification for all of the programs. The DBE program manager is located in ODOT. They handle the requirements or the monitoring requirements for the federal government. We also handle all of the Oregon administrative rules for the MW and ESB programs, and we handle any complaints that may occur.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Carrie, of just sort of the basics of how MW, ESBs, and DBEs work? Okay, thank you, Carrie. I'll be calling you back up when we... as we get into the bill itself. Thank you. So I'm going to call up, we have a panel from the City of Portland who brought this issue forward. Andy Smith, Margie Solinger, and Christine Moody, you could come up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andy Smith for the City of Portland. With me today is Margie Solinger. She's the Ombudsman for the City of Portland, and Christine Moody, who's our Chief Procurement Officer. The City of Portland has received a number of complaints from state-certified MWBE firms over the last few years that other state-certified firms are obtaining work on city contracts, city projects, and they're not doing the work, and instead they're passing that work on to non-certified firms to do to complete the work. The statutory term for that action is failing to perform a commercially useful function. But the common understanding is fraud. And this fraud has the effect of undermining the city and the state's efforts to support equity in contracting opportunities, and it represents a misappropriation of limited public resources. The City of Portland and other local contracting agencies lack authority under current law to take enforcement action against state-certified firms that fail to perform a commercially useful function. Over the last 9 months, the City of Portland has met with Business Oregon to figure out the best approach to closing this gap in enforcement authority over CUF violations. And the legislation before you today represents an approach that came out of several of those discussions between the City of Portland and Business Oregon. And I'll just take a few minutes to walk you through some of the key points of the legislation. First, I'll note that Legislative Council took an opportunity to do some cleanup work in the statute, and in our view, they're very good changes and helps the statute read better. In Section 3 of the bill, subsection 1, that is the part of the statute where local agencies have concurrent enforcement authority with the state. Local agencies do not have concurrent enforcement authority over subsection 2 of that section. So to address that, we added subpart D to subsection 1 to clarify that local agencies can enforce CUF violations concurrently with Business Oregon. Also in subsection 1, we changed the length of time agencies can suspend an MWBE firm from bidding on or receiving an award for a public contract from 90 days on the first instance to 1 year, and from 1 year on the second instance to 3 years. And finally, in section 2 of the bill, in subsection 3, we've clarified that if a local agency does the enforcement under that statute, that section of statute, which deals with other fraudulent conduct that is not CUF violations, that the local agency can keep the statutory fine rather than sending that to the state. We've continued to work with Business Oregon and other stakeholders and expect to have some technical amendments for your consideration shortly. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We'd appreciate your support on this bill, and we're happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, great. Margie, Christine, do you have testimony that you'd like to give? You're here,
here for questions.
To back up Mr. Smith.
Right.
Great. Okay, colleagues.
Pretty straightforward.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to ask Tracy Rutten to come up. And Carrie, maybe you could come back up at this point. Tracy, welcome.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities.
And in an effort to kind of keep with that theme of pretty straightforward, the League is here to express our support for Senate Bill 584. As indicated by Andy Smith with City of Portland, we are interested in pursuing maybe one technical fix that we saw in the bill, but conceptually we are supportive of the measure and thank the City of Portland for bringing this forward as another tool to be able to enforce this statute better. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Carrie, your perspective on this issue?
Regarding the bill, we agree with the City of Portland that it will allow for a clearer understanding of what the roles are. And we're fine with the changes that we've come to agree upon.
Okay, great. Any questions, colleagues? Thank you. We're all so agreeable today, boy, I'll tell you. Okay, thank you, both of you. Finally, I'd ask Joe Esmond and John Molis to come forward, please. Okay, the voice of the workers.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Molis. I represent the Oregon State Building Trades Council. Here to testify in support of the bill that's before you from the City of Portland. And I just wanted to give you kind of a general perspective of some of my observations, given my past history. I started my apprenticeship 37 years ago last month in the masonry industry and have spent pretty much my entire adult life in the construction industry. And when the focus on MBE and WBE contracting started, frankly, what I saw a lot of were contractors that looked like me setting their wives up in business and then subbing part of the projects to them, and that's how they would comply. And that wasn't, I don't believe, the intent of the law at all. Frankly, a lot of it was a joke. And over the years, that changed, and it got legitimate, and entities popped up that helped small contractors and minority contractors and women contractors become legitimate and, you know, become mainstream contractors that did good work and they actually ran the work. And over the last few years, I've seen it going the other way. I've seen it to where, as described earlier, there's pass-throughs going on. I had an example from one of my affiliates last year, a contractor that subbed, or that the contractor's wife started a separate company. They subbed part of the work to them. All the books are in one office, all the payroll's in one office. They've got photos of the employees for the sub, who are the same employees that work for the majority contractor on the same scaffold and the same snorkel lifts. Again, I don't think that's the intent of the law at all. And I think it's hurting legitimate MBE and WBE subcontractors. And I'll just close with I think the problem is there's not any real enforcement out there. There's nobody that's enforcing the rules of the road. And I'll close with a personal story. Coming down here today, I left the house a little late, and so I'm going a wee bit, maybe more than a little wee bit, over the speed limit. And about Woodburn, all of a sudden, everything slows down to about 65 miles an hour. And I'm going, what, some idiot in the fast lane, they need to move over? Well, it turns out there's an Oregon State Patrol there with a radar gun. So these people weren't slowing down out of the goodness of their heart. They were slowing down because there was somebody there. I'm just glad there was a couple of people in front of me so I didn't get the ticket. With that, I'll close, Mr. Chair, and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullis. Mr. Esmond.
I have to top that. For the record,
you got the ticket.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Esmond. I am a business agent for the IBW Local 48, representing roughly 4,400 men and women in the Portland metro area. Some of this reason why the bill is here is probably because of me. We have signatory contractors, minority contractors, okay? Most of the time, they come out of the field. We have a minority who wants to start a business. And in our world, our industry works together. This person's success, we're all success. So he came to me and said, I'm having some problems because I'm getting scammed. Let's cut through the chase. Let's cut through the words. And it was on a city contract. And I went to somebody in the city. And they wrote a letter to Business Oregon. I'm not trying to embarrass anybody, but just a couple years of frustration. and this person couldn't get any satisfaction out of Business Oregon. So I'm happy, more than happy to see the city of Portland bring this bill forward, and maybe we can make the field level. You know, our employers pay good wages and health care and pensions, and let's make it fair for everyone. So with that, I'll probably keep my mouth shut.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Alex, any questions of Ms. Mullis or Ms. Davis?
Thank you.
No, I have a comment.
Oh, just, yes.
That sometimes there are, having been involved with that part of the industry and involved with that part of the industry currently, sometimes you even get contractors who will write down a DBE's business and use that to fulfill a contractual requirement and never inform the DBE that their work's coming up, and they'll just end up doing it themselves. That's happened a few times to me. I mean, you're wanting to do the work, right, yet they're coming up with reasons that they just didn't bother to tell you about your work portion coming up. So I would hope that wouldn't go against the DBE, but would actually go the other way towards the contractor who did right. such a thing.
So. And I'm happy to see that it's going to be a year a fine and a year disbarment forbidding that kind of work. It discourages minority contractors from trying to expand themselves. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That point came up, and we had a small group meeting to help me understand this issue, and that point was made, and I was astonished, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Chair Denbro, Senator Thatcher, I would agree with your observations, and that's the kind of stuff that, and I don't know how frequently it happens, but whenever it happens, it's not right, and there needs to be some rules in place to make sure that it doesn't happen. Yep. It's just not fair to the contractors and MBEWB subs that are trying to play it by the rules and play it straight.
Okay, great. Thank you both of you. Andy, could you come up just for a moment, one last time? One of the issues I'm just reminded that came up in the little meeting that we had was just clarification that what we're dealing with here is the ability to bid on future work. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure.
Just put it on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's one of the technical pieces that we're working through with some of the stakeholders right now. I mean, I think that, you know, we have some further discussions to have to figure out, you know, what we're trying to get at locally compared to with, you know, what the concerns are. But I think that's something that we're going to be able to work through.
Right. And the goal is we don't want to disrupt projects that are underway or, you know, in an overly burdensome way.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. We want to make sure that whatever enforcement we're doing is reasonable in context, and that we have the ability to do certain things that take enforcement action against this type of work without, you know, unduly putting the burden on one party or another.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thanks a lot, Andy. Colleagues, we'll await the settlement and the projected amendments that will come from that, and then schedule a work session. So with that, I will close this public hearing on Senate Bill 584, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 496. And Senator Devlin, you want to come up and, yeah, and while you're doing that, Matt, tell us what this bill is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 496 permits certain occupational injuries or diseases to qualify for benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund.
Okay, Senator Devlin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19, Chair Denbro, members of the committee. I am here to speak in support of SB 496, which is a bill that includes certain compensable workers' compensation claims as qualifying criteria for eligibility for benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund. You will hear from me and you will hear from other speakers about how limited this change is. I think there is somewhat of a perception out there that we might be opening the door to far more claims than we've had in the past. The reality is this is to open the door to potentially maybe one or two claims every 3 or 4 years that are clearly as justifiable as any claims that you might currently have for the fund. As you know, the Public Safety Memorial Fund provides benefits for public safety officers who have suffered a qualifying disability or a family member of a public safety officer who has suffered a qualifying death or disability. Currently, a qualifying death or disability must be linked to a specific enforcement action or emergency response. This, in effect, to many people, was an oversight and when the bill was put in place first back in the 1990s and should not have been the case. The Public Safety Memorial Fund does not currently have the legal ability to presume deaths or disabilities are the result of long-term or continued events. The bill would give that legal authority ability to the Public Safety Memorial Fund. Some disabilities or deaths are the result of long-term continued events, like cancer in firefighters as a result of exposure to multiple cancer-causing agents while performing their duties. This bill would change so the benefits could be given a public safety officer with workers' compensation eligible injury or illness leading to his or her death. Using the workers' compensation definition, which is very narrow in this particular case, for disability will bring clarity for the application of the law. This is a very, and I'm going to say this again, this is a very limited expansion that I believe some of the speakers here will explain in greater detail. Particularly, I believe you have a letter that has been, you've received from Bob Livingston, which will explain that in greater detail from the Oregon State Firefighters Council. This bill will modernize the Public Service Memorial Fund so that it can continue to fulfill its original purpose, providing support for those who have risked their lives to keep us safe. Please consider supporting SB 496 and passing it through the committee with a due pass recommendation. I thank you for your time. I'm here to answer any questions, but there are probably people more qualified than I am to answer your questions in the room.
Colleagues, any questions of the senator? All right, thank you very much for bringing this forward, Senator Devlin.
Thank you.
Okay, let's hear from Bob Livingston and Luann Schrader, please. Bob, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, Legislative Director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and with me today is Mrs. Schrader, who, difficult situation, but unfortunately, some nearly 20-plus years later, 15-plus years later, we discovered that there was not quite a statutory issue that needed to be addressed from when the inception in 1999, that at the time, many of you know, in my opinion, one of the true statesmen that ever served in this body, and not only in this body, but also served as our treasurer, when at the time, Representative Ben Westland noted that we had a problem due to some tragic deaths that occurred in 1999. With that, at the time, then Representative Westland reached out to many of us in the public safety community to say, hey, do we have any issues or anything on the books to care for the families or for those public safety officers that either do one of two things. One, die in the line of duty that is articulated by Senator Devlin, that is an immediate action, as well as these an action, enforceable action, or if they have a permanent and total disability. In that particular race to get that legislation done, what has occurred is we did accidentally left out a situation that some of these times an injury that is a permanent or total disability or a death is not immediate or is not during the enforceable action. And so with that, this bill will correct what I believe would have been something that was in the original bill. And if I could, prior to turning it over to Mrs. Schrader, who has enough courage to be with us today to tell her tough and difficult story, I need to point out a few things specifically in the bill. One, this bill does not change anything as it relates to the definition under what is deemed to be a permanent and total disability under ORS 656206. For those that have been brave enough to entertain workers' comp and know the definition of a permanent and total disability. That is an extremely high threshold. And in fact, prior to doing research for this piece of legislation, I reached out to DCBS, which, as you know, does a very good job of providing good statistical data as it relates to a whole cadre of issues around workers' comp. And in what they provided to me, specifically to permanent and total disabilities, which is one of the qualifiers along with death for this bill, is that from the years 2011 to 2013, there were 32 permanent and total disabilities system-wide. That is system-wide of the entire workers' compensation. That is not 32 public safety officers. In fact, during that time in the research that they provided to me, there was only one qualifying event that fit the definition of a public safety officer that is in Senate Bill 496, not only from the inception, but in this bill itself. And so with that, it is our intent and it's our belief that, again, this will correct an unintended consequence of trying to do the right thing way back in 1999. And because of such a rare events, it's where it's difficult for me, but I'd like to be able to turn this over to the courageous woman that's next to me to provide to you really kind of the genesis and the reasoning on why we're here today to hear this narrow but very important bill, Mr. Chair, and then I'd take questions at the end if that's okay by you.
That's great. Thank you, Bob. Ms. Schrader, thank you very much for coming. If you could just introduce yourself with your name for the record, please. Thank you.
My name is Lou Ann Schrader, and I'm here on behalf of my husband, Dan Schrader. He passed away in April of 2014. He had worked for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue for 37 years. He was very passionate about his career, loved helping people. He retired in 2011 and 18 months later was diagnosed with Burkitt's lymphoma. So the treatment didn't go like we planned. Because he passed away in April. Before he passed away, he was told that this was a cancer presumptive ruling and that he should file for workers' comp with SAFE. So he had started that. Unfortunately, he didn't see it, the end result, but SAFE accepted this workers' comp claim, and it went through with no questions. So I was, as part of the benefits, he was considered a fallen firefighter in the line of duty, and he was nationally recognized by the International Association of Firefighters. The memorial in Colorado Springs in September. His name was put on the wall as a fallen firefighter. I even received a letter from the President of the United States, from Senator Merkley. I applied for benefits on behalf of him, recognized as a fallen firefighter with TPSST, and a short time later was denied benefits. They did not recognize the cancer presumptive ruling on the Burkitt's lymphoma. They said I would have to have proof of his exposure. I didn't have any proof of exposure, but we all know it's there. He could come home after getting off duty and he would blow black stuff out of his nose for 2 days. So I'm just here today to ask you to do the right thing. This may not benefit me, but it will pay it forward for somebody else, and that they don't have to go through that with DPSST, that they do the right thing. I recognize this.
Thank you very much, Luann.
Mr. Chair, if I could please, just to wrap up a couple of points. One, again, it's that the issue that the Schrader family came across was the fact that it wasn't an immediate action. It was a delayed, you know, it was years of service. It was an accepted compensable claim. Fortunately, most of the time, and we're hopeful to catch these early, and, you know, he was able to survive that. Even with that, this bill is a narrow exception because, you know, the consolation, if there is, which there's not, is that a public safety officer is either going to die and it's going to be a compensable injury, or he's going to meet the definition of a permanent and total disability. It's not going to be your back injury. It's not going to be some of those routine type injuries that are accepted under workers' comp that happened throughout our career. And I would just close with the fact that as a public safety officer and somebody that has served for over 22 years as a firefighter in this state, the one thing that whether you're a police officer or a firefighter, when it comes to protecting those that give the ultimate sacrifice or have a permanent and total disability, we make sure that only those that should be bestowed with that highest honor should receive those type of benefits, which is why we have worked extremely hard with my bias, but really someone that this body's really going to sorely lose in the fact when Charlie Cheek from Legislative Council, who has worked on workers' comp issues for 30-plus years, is no longer going to be of service. And so with this, we have done, I believe, a commendable job to make this narrow in focus so that it does attract those people that are eligible under a permanent and total disability as well as a death, but also honors those that give the ultimate sacrifice. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Bob. Colleagues, questions? Bob, let me just say, it's all a blur now, but was it just 2 years ago or a few years ago that we had legislation around cancer presumption and, you know, just looking at the sorts of toxics that firefighters are exposed to and the effects of those on their health. Am I remembering that correctly?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's four years ago now. You know, finally, I think one of the good things is that the science has caught up and we are understanding and really recognizing that occupational exposures are a significant hazard that many of our workers have, not just firefighters but others. But the science was there to back this up. And as you know, this body, along with a lot of hard work from a lot of people, recognized this, and that's one of the reasons why we have that. To that note, though, this bill is not just exclusive to firefighters. This certainly could be the police officer that walks in unbeknownly into a meth lab and all of the toxins that they're exposed to. And again, as long as it is a compensable injury, they either unfortunately die or have a permanent and total disability, they too would be eligible for benefits under the Public Safety Memorial Fund. So this is exclusive to those unique situations, and in our recognition in the 21st century that our public safety officers are exposed to many dangers, and some of those are not as obvious as an immediate action like what we saw in 1999 when the original bill was passed.
Thanks, Bob. And will Mr. Schrader be included in this year's Fallen Worker Memorial recognition? Do you know?
Or
was he in the previous one?
Mr. Chair, we will check on that, and if not, definitely make sure that that occurs.
Yeah, I usually go to those very moving ceremonies.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schrader. Thanks, Mr. Livingston. All right, we'll call up Lindsay Hale from DPSST, please.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Hale. I'm the Professional Standards Division Director at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. As that, part of my duties include administering the Public Safety Memorial Fund in conjunction with a six-member Public Safety Memorial Fund board. Currently, the Memorial Fund board membership is made up of two public safety administrators, three represented officers, and one public member who represent all of the public safety disciplines in the state. Members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate and also are required to be current sitting members of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training. These six individuals are the ones who are responsible for making eligibility determinations in regards to the Memorial Fund. The Memorial Fund, not to rehash what Senator Devlin said, but just a little bit of background, the Memorial Fund was established in 1999 as a means to provide immediate but temporary financial relief for public safety officers and their families following a qualifying death or permanent total disability that was suffered in the line of duty. The fund is established to assist the families who are reliant on the salary and benefits provided by that public safety officer and were designed to be immediate in recognition of the months and sometimes years it takes for other benefits to kick in. The fund defines public safety officer as a police to include reserve officers, fire service professionals to include volunteers, parole and probation officers, corrections officers, and those working for OIA in a correctional capacity. In all, it's approximately 20,000 individuals that the fund covers. To be eligible for the benefits under the current law, an officer must suffer a qualifying death or disability, which is defined as resulting from an enforcement action or an emergency response, or the training for enforcement action or emergency response, or the result of an officer's position as being a public safety officer. And the death or disability must be a direct or proximate result from one single incident. Current benefits include a one-time lump sum payment of $25,000 that's mandated to be paid within 14 days after an eligibility determination is made, and also discretionary benefits, which may include up to 12 months of mortgage payments, health and dental benefit reimbursement, and scholarship considerations for all eligible beneficiaries. DPSST and the Memorial Fund Board are, of course, neutral and will administer this law in accordance with whatever the eligibility determines. At this point, we are unable to say what a fiscal impact would be. However, Director Gablix and I had the opportunity to discuss this proposed legislation prior to this hearing, and as a result, some of the angst that was written into our testimony provided to you has been relieved. And if the committee is agreeable, I'd like to ask that Mr. Cheek from Legislative Council address the committee on the record as to some scenarios which would fall into the new proposed legislation and which wouldn't.
Charlie, could you come up now? This is a rare privilege for us.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, legs asleep.
Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. Charlie Cheek from Legislative Council. Your question?
Just following up on Lindsay's comment about potential impacts or implications of the drafting.
Right. I think that there's a little bit of confusion floating around about whether or not this expands the pool of potential recipients. And it does only to a very limited extent. And I think the key point to keep in mind is that the only qualifying conditions are death or permanent and total disability. Now, our workers' comp system is quite capable of making those determinations in terms of its relationship to your employment. They do that frequently. And this bill simply states that if that process has occurred and the injury or death is found to be a compensable work-related injury, then that qualifies that person for eligibility under the fund. Okay, it does not expand the definition of what a disabling or qualifying death is. It simply takes that determination and allows it to be made by those agencies that are most qualified to do it, our workers' comp system, and then also the Portland system, which has always been kind of a carve-out, but that's existed both in the firefighters' presumption as well as other places in Chapter 656, bringing them in, there's a special relationship. But there, so in other words, the worker would have to have been permanently and totally disabled under 656 or under the equivalent in Portland in order to be eligible for this. And the standard under 656 is simply that you cannot return to your job at injury and are capable of being employed at a gainful occupation for gainful wages, and the courts have defined that as the minimum wage in Oregon. So if you can hold a minimum wage job in Oregon, you are not permanently and totally disabled. Okay. So, and then all it does is simply say, and it really ties into both the firefighters' presumptions about heart disease and cancer and lung diseases, because this is the other piece of it. This is the other end of it. And as we've learned over the years, especially with our more sophisticated medical knowledge in relationship to the long-term effects of exposures, both for our veterans and others, that it takes time sometimes for these diseases to manifest themselves. But whether or not those diseases would be compensable will already have been determined by the time the board has to make a decision about eligibility for the fund. So they don't have to undertake that task. That task will be accomplished. A claimant would simply have to provide documentation to the fund that they had a permanent and total disability or death that was compensable under whatever comp system was covering.
Thank you. That's a very clear presentation. Colleagues, any questions of either Ms. Hale or Mr. Cheek? Okay, thank you. Thank you very both. thank you both very much. we've also gotten a request from Tim Cowan to address the committee.
Senator Dembro,
yes.
I'll provide in writing.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, colleagues, we will work on setting up a work session on this. So with that, I'll close this public hearing on Senate Bill 496, and I will open a work session.
No, we don't have to,
so we don't have to open a work session.
No, but this one needs to notice.
Okay. So we have a work session scheduled for Senate Bill 128. The fiscal is not done, so just serve notice. We will hopefully hear this on Wednesday. Okay, anything else, colleagues, for the good of the order? All right, seeing none, we're adjourned.
Really?
Yeah. We're adjourned.
Really?